You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Brookings for this book talk by Dan Baltz, author of Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. For those of you who think you've come to hear about Syria, that's in the next room. And I suspect there might be some people sitting in the next room wondering what Syria had to do with the election of 2012. So we may see them in here shortly. We've got a great group here to talk about Dan's book. And let me just introduce them. John Harwood. John is the chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for the New York Times. I'm sure many of you have seen him on television. Bill Galston, senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution, who has often written about politics, often with me. and right here, who I will introduce, our guest of honor, Dan Baltz. Dan was educated at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He joined the United States Army, unusual among his generation. He worked for the National Enquirer and the National Journal and the Philadelphia Inquirer.
He wishes
he worked for the National.
Right. I was burnishing your journalistic credentials.
Right. I'm going with that.
And in 1978, he joined the Washington Post, and he's been there ever since. He's the senior political correspondent. He fills the role of our beloved David Broder, who everybody paid attention to what he said about politics, and for a new generation, everyone pays attention to what Dan Baltz says about politics. So without further ado, I'd like to have Dan talk about his book for a little bit. The book is available for sale outside, and Dan will sign books when this is finished. So we're going to have Dan talk for a couple minutes, and then I'm going to call on John and Bill to start the conversation, and we'll extend it to all of you. Dan?
Thank you, Elaine. Elaine was, I think, the first person who contacted me about doing a book talk many, many months ago, so I'm grateful to you and Brookings and Anna who helped make the arrangements. It's a pleasure to have John Harwood here, who's a great reporter and who throws the best bipartisan dance party in Washington every year. And Bill Galston has stepped in nobly for Ron Brownstein, who could not make it at the last minute. And Bill is a more than worthy fill-in. I think everybody here who knows Bill and knows Ron would pay money to see the two of them go do a deep dive on political data and discuss the ways of the world. So I'm happy to be part of this. Let me just talk for a few minutes, as Elaine said, about Collision 2012. This was a sequel in most respects to the book that Haynes Johnson and I did on the 2008 campaign, and obviously a totally different book, as it turned out. I mean, because we had a totally different campaign in 2012. I think this was as we look back on 2008, obviously a historic campaign, and in so many ways had a lot of uplift to it. People came out of that election feeling pretty good about the country, even people who had voted for John McCain. And so that book was a reflection of what was an extraordinary election and a moment in the country that I think, we look back on and think, what was that really about? Because it disappeared so quickly. I mean, this campaign was obviously much grittier, much more negative. When I started out this project, I was not sure that this book would produce a story as compelling as the 2008 campaign because of the history that was made, because of the epic battle that took place between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. This one was a stranger campaign, particularly the Republican nomination battle, and we can talk about that a little bit. David Marinus, my Post colleague, who wrote a wonderful biography of Barack Obama, came up to me at one point in the late fall of 2011 as the Republicans were watching one after another implausible candidate kind of rise to challenge Mitt Romney. And he said to me, with all due respect to you, you know, quote unquote, distinguished political reporters, he said, we really need Hunter Thompson to tell the story of the 2012 campaign. And I thought he was right about that. When I finished this book, as I was finishing this book, what struck me was that in so many ways, for all of the aspects of the 2012 campaign that I think people found unappealing, this election told us more about who we are as a country and where we are as a country than the 2008 campaign did. And I think in that way, if not a more important election to look at, as significant in trying to understand how we got to where we are. I call this book Collision 2012 for several reasons. One, it was, in essence, a clash between the America that had elected Obama in 2008 and the America that elected Republicans to the House in 2010. And we can talk about, obviously, the nature of the different electorates that showed up in those two elections. But nonetheless, those two elections framed two different views of the country. It was a clash of philosophies, Republican, Democrat, a significant gap engulfed between how Democrats and Republicans saw a lot of the basic questions that were facing the country, whether it had to do with what to do about the economy, what role government could play in stimulating the economy, the size and scope of government, and obviously a great division and a great clash of philosophies on many of the social issues. And the third reason I called it Collision 2012 was because it was a collision between two very different personalities. I mean, if you think of the life experience of Barack Obama and the life experience of Mitt Romney, it could hardly be more different in the way they grew up, in the way their early lives were formed, and particularly in the way they came to politics. I mean, one being a community organizer is his route into politics, and Romney's obviously through private sector experience. I think it's hard to overstate how different the two men saw the world and in a sense, how much they disrespected the other's view of the world and the positions they took. As I talked to the two campaigns, you could just sense that President Obama had very little respect for the way Mitt Romney saw the world, and I think vice versa. And so those were the reasons for the title. When you do a book like this, when a journalist does a book like this, when you approach a campaign, there are two ways to tell the story. One is the obvious way of inside out, and any book undertaken by a journalist seeks to look behind the scenes. What was really going on inside the campaigns? What were the decisions like? What were the disagreements like? What was happening at crucial points, and how did people see it in retrospect as they did it? And part of what I tried to do, as I think every author does, is, you know, when you're dealing with a story in which everybody knows the basic outline. Everybody knows how it started. Everybody knows the ups and downs. Everybody knows how it ends. And so part of the challenge is to try to come up with, you know, fresh material that says to people, yes, you followed this closely, but you didn't know everything that was really going on. And that was part of what I was trying to do in this book. You know, I did a long interview with Mitt Romney at the end of January, just after the president was sworn in for his second term. And it was a really interesting interview. It was just the two of us. There was no aide present, no press secretary sitting there watching the clock. And I found Romney quite interesting that day. We talked for 90 minutes. He was pretty open. He was pretty candid about some things. And he was, I thought, in other places, still digesting, if you will, maybe a kind way to put it, what had actually happened, particularly the 47% episode in which, when we talked about it, I think he was still in denial that he had actually said what he said, and challenged me when I suggested he had said that the 47% of the country would never take control of their own lives. He said, I didn't say that. His iPad was sitting on a counter nearby. He jumped up and got it and went through it, tried to read to me what he had said. But I think what it was a reflection of the fact that he knew how damaging that moment had been, and could not still express the idea that he had actually said that if he had, it did not reflect what he really felt. He talked about his confidence and winning. I said, I take it you were quite confident the morning of the election that you were going to be the next president. And he said, not 90% confident, but he said, yeah, I thought we were going to win the election. And he said, one example, he said, I had written, he called it an acceptance speech, a victory speech. He said, I had not written a concession speech. And he arrived back in Boston after a day of campaigning on Election Day, thinking he was going to be president. He arrived back in Boston, and they saw the early exit poll numbers, and they all suddenly realized that this campaign was not going to turn out the way it did. He was also interesting on the self-deportation issue, which obviously had hurt him. His view of that is that the phrase self-deportation was benign and not offensive, and we talked about that at some length as he tried to explain how he was quite surprised by the reaction to that comment and still could not quite understand why it had come to hurt him. And in his own mind, felt that he had not really run in the primaries on the immigration issue. When we all know he attacked Rick Perry on the immigration issue, he attacked Newt Gingrich on the immigration issue. But as he said, I told my campaign, I don't want to run on immigration, and yet this was another place where I thought that he was somewhat in denial about it. I thought, interesting stuff about Chris Christie in the book. It was brand new to me, and I think brand new to a lot of people, of the actual process he went through in deciding not to run, and the back and forth he had with the Romney campaign about the vice presidency, and also backstage tirade at the convention when he was told his video was not going to run at the before his speech, when he gave the keynote address, and some of the threats he offered up to the directors before they finally yielded. So the process of going behind the scenes, particularly on the Republican side, I think, in fact, did yield a lot of new material. One of the things I've always tried to do in a book like this and in my own reporting is to try to get the principles into the book. I think a book like this is more valuable when you can talk to the people who actually ran for president and get them to describe what they went through, either in real time or after the fact. So there's a lot in here. The one big hole in here is President Obama, who did not agree to do an interview for this book. He did two interviews when Haynes and I did the 08 book, but for whatever reasons, the White House decided they weren't going to participate in any of the books this year. And so that's a hole. One of the things I wanted to try to understand better was just how the Obama campaign went about getting to where they were in terms of both message and in terms of their operation. There's a fair amount in the book, on how they developed the middle class message and why they developed it and how they developed it and why I think in retrospect it was significant because of the way it put Romney into a box that he could not get out of, and the degree to which they had structured a middle class message to avoid and to head off the idea that the campaign could ever become a real referendum on the president's handling of the economy, or even a judgment about the current state of the economy, that they knew that if they got into that situation, the president's opportunity to win would be much, much more difficult. And then the other thing I wanted to do was try to understand better and try to explain better the way in which the campaign used data and analytics and modeling and all sorts of technology to both get a better grasp of the electorate, but also to make their ground game much more efficient. I would not say that their ground game was decisive in the end, given the ultimate size of the popular vote and the way the states went. But there's no question that they had a much superior ground game to the Romney team, and the way they did it is a fascinating story. The precision with which they went after individual voters almost is something that I think every campaign that's looking at 2016 will be going to school on. So there's the inside-out story, but there's also the outside-in story, and I think too often we in the media either ignore or underplay or dismiss the larger forces that ultimately helped to decide a campaign. In this case, it was obviously the economy. And in shorthand, the question was the economy just good enough to allow Barack Obama to win re-election, or was it just bad enough that it would make it possible for Mitt Romney to win? Obviously, in the end, it was just good enough. I mean, there was economic growth that was tepid, but it was enough to make it possible for him to win against some odds. The second big force, obviously, are the demographic changes. It was surprising in so many ways that the Republicans woke up the morning after the election and said, we have a problem with the Hispanic community. I mean, this is a problem that they've had for literally for decades, and with some exceptions, this has been a persistent problem. I mean, George W. Bush did pretty well with the Hispanic vote, certainly in Texas and in his 2004 campaign. But as a party, the Republican Party has been on the wrong side of that community and those issues. But the demographic forces, I mean, Bill Frey has written wonderfully about this, as have others here, at this point are pushing, in a presidential year, are pushing in the direction of the Democrats. The rising parts of the population are more Democratic than are the other parts of the population, whether it's the Hispanic vote or younger voters or new voters, and trying to understand and describe how those forces intersected with the campaigns. And the third aspect of this, which is, I think, one of the enduring issues that we have to deal with that existed before this campaign, but I think was made even more stark in this campaign, and that's the red-blue divide. I mean, we talk about red and blue America almost in a cliched way. We all remember Obama's 2004 keynote address in which he essentially said, we can get beyond this. We can be the United States of America, not red America and blue America. And yet I think this campaign was shaped in so many ways by those red-blue divisions, particularly the red side of it and the opposition to President Obama. And I think that we came out of this even more divided than we had been. I mean, the notion that we have elections to have a big debate, which then helps to resolve some of the differences in the country and point us in a direction forward, I think we learned in this campaign that at least in the environment that we're in now, in the era we're in now, that's not necessarily the case, that elections tend to be temporary events, and we quickly returned, in a sense, regular order, which at this point is a great divide between the two parties. And so in doing this book, that I was trying to talk not only about how campaigns operated and to tell that story in an engaging way, but to remind people that there are other things that have as significant an impact on the outcome of the elections. And so with that, I will turn it over to John and
John, comments?
Well, I just wanted to expand on one point that Dan made about 2012 telling us more about the country than 2008, which I think is true and a valuable insight. You know, in many ways, 2008 was a cyclical election in which you'd had a two-term Republican president who was extremely unpopular, a war that was very unpopular, a financial crisis. All that created conditions for the party of change to come in, notwithstanding the fact that you had an African-American Democratic nominee, which we're accustomed to thinking of as something that was very difficult to achieve in the first place and then to win a general election. But you had much more neutral and even conditions in 2012 for competition. You had a weaker economy. You had an incumbent who had advantages of incumbency, as they tend to do, in particular not having a nomination fight and being able to tune this machine throughout the course of his first term and be prepared to do the analytics that Dan was talking about. And a nominee who, you know, I think Mitt Romney ultimately was a bad candidate because he was not an authentic candidate. He didn't feel comfortable in his own skin, but he was somebody who was a presentable candidate who, in a circumstance when the country's evenly divided, if he could get to the nomination, which he did, not grotesquely crippled, just a little bit crippled. He could be in a competitive situation. But what you ultimately had was a competition between the America that was and the America that we're in the process of becoming. And nobody knows exactly when those lines cross in a definitive way, and there's still some debate among Republicans about whether they in fact have crossed. But what you've got is a white party, an older conservative white party, male-tilting party, and a Democratic party that is benefiting from all the demographic changes and the passage of time, cultural changes within the country. And to me, the most dramatic reflection of that was thinking about the difference between 2004 and 2012, when 2004, among a bunch of things going on, you had Republicans using social issues as an offensive weapon. Mm-hmm. And being able to surf the underlying cultural conservatism of a critical mass of the country to use those issues to protect an incumbent who was shaky, as Barack Obama was somewhat shaky in 2012. And in this election, enough had changed that those same social issues became an offensive weapon for the Democrats. The Democrats wanted to talk about gay marriage. They wanted to talk about threats to women's health and abortion and all those sorts of things. And I think that was an important marker that 2012 clarified about where we're going. And to me, the challenge for Republicans going forward is they are in a they're sort of trapped within a paradigm and a way of thinking and a political base that is barring them from connecting with the rest of the country, and they've got to figure out some way to break out of that. And they clearly have not figured that out yet. They may have to lose another national election before they're compelled to figure it out. They still have enough strength to hold, I would expect, the House of Representatives, unless the little jail that they exist in is so confining that they, for example, shut down the government and have a debt crisis in 3 weeks, which, if it happens, could actually blast them out of the majority of the House of Representatives.
That's right.
Great. Thank you. Bill?
Well, I want to raise four or five questions very quickly that I hope Dan can talk about and the rest of us can talk about as well. But first of all, just to be a little bit contentious, I actually think that Romney came out of the primaries pretty badly damaged. I think he was badly damaged on immigration. I think the release of his tax plan badly damaged him. I think his failure to release his tax returns was damaging. I think the fact that it was Newt Gingrich who opened the front on Bain so conspicuously opened the door for the summer assault. And I absolutely agree with you. On women's issues, he did less than nothing to separate himself from the most unregenerate members of his own party. He had sister soldier opportunities to burn. He didn't avail himself of any of them. And so I think that, I think you're absolutely right that the base of the Republican Party drags potential nominees away from where they want to be. I just think that Romney was dragged quite far from where he should have been.
I'll let the other guys talk, but the only disagreement I would have is that to the extent that Romney was damaged and flawed entering the general election, I think the core of the flaw existed before the primary campaign ever started, which was the authenticity point that I mentioned, which is he's somebody who was pretending to be acceptable to a party that he didn't actually fit in, that didn't want him. It's just that the other candidates were so weak that he was going to win the nomination. And so I think problems of identity and fit with the party preexisted the
I absolutely agree with that, and I think the list that I just gave represents in many ways the things he was compelled to do.
Reflections of that, yeah.
Reflections of that.
I just want to make, on this point, one of my favorite pieces of reporting in the book is Stu Stevens, the Romney's top advisor. Dan has quoted him saying that elections are like high school. You are who you hang out with. and that was to this point of the damage done by the rest of the Republican Party to a guy who, yes, didn't fit, but also then got damaged by association.
Yeah. Even if you're just the bartender in the Star Wars bar, you're still there, you know.
Well, that was Stewart's view of what happened in, as a result of the debates.
Yeah, right.
That
yeah.
If you stand up on that stage for 20 debates with that cast of characters, it has an effect on how people perceive you. Even if you had done brilliantly, which, as we know, he often did well
in
the debates.
He often did well, yeah.
But he had moments when he did not do well.
Absolutely.
And those stuck out.
So, anyway, here are my questions, Dan.
All right.
Okay. Question one, you know, a couple of conventional political science maxims were pretty frontally challenged in this campaign. Maxim number one, in elections involving incumbents, the re-election campaign is primarily a referendum on the incumbent. And the question is, to what extent was that not true in 2012? Because the Obama campaign labored mightily, and I think your judgment is with some success, to shift from a referendum to a choice. Conventional political science maxim number two, after 4 years, the incumbent owns the economy. Exit polls indicated, you know, that more than 50% of the people, after casting their votes in 2012, still blame Bush more than Obama. So, you know, maybe that's not true either. So that's my first question. Wither conventional political science after the 2012 election. Here's my second question. I have long believed that politically and perhaps substantively as well, the single most important decision that the Obama folks made in the first 6 months was the auto bailout. I don't think he could have won Ohio without the auto bailout. You know, and there's great qualitative as well as quantitative research to support that point. And I wonder whether he would have been nearly as strong in the Midwest absent the auto bailout. Query, if he'd done everything else the same but hadn't bailed out the auto industry, would it have been a different election? That's my second question. Here's my third question. Within the Republican Party, you know, I think the key split is between mainstream conservatism, which Romney represented, and conservative populism, which Santorum ended up representing. And you have a very interesting stat about states where Romney won as opposed to the ones where Santorum won, you know, the 50% Christian evangelical threshold. Why wasn't there a stronger populist challenge to the establishment at the presidential level? It's very strong, as we know, at the congressional level. But, you know, this populist challenge within the Republican Party is not a new story. It's been going on for a while. But no well-organized populist insurgency with some real intellectual, political, and financial heft has really surfaced. Why not? Here's my fourth question. With regard to Obama, you make a series of very interesting points. You know, first of all, that there was a contradiction at the heart of his first campaign and the way his first administration between the promise to transcend the politics of polarization on the one hand and the fact that he was a pretty traditional liberal on the other. And you talk about squaring the circle. You also argue, and you have an interview with him to back this up, you know, that he, you know, verbally he made the standard New Democrat move, right, that the issue wasn't big government versus small government, but smart government versus dumb government. But you point out that he failed to persuade the electorate that he was on, you know, that he was on the smart government side of that of that divide. You make the point that he has technocratic tendencies, that he tends to believe that if you get the smartest people in the room together and shut the door, they'll come up with the right answer, and that right answer can then be sold to the rest of the country. And you also say that he had difficulty putting himself into the minds of his opposition, understanding not only what they believe, but why they believe it, and how a person who wasn't really, you know, ignorant or evil could possibly believe such things. To what extent do those four features of, you know, of Obama the president help explain the Obama presidency? Here's my fifth question. And this is my fifth and final question. You make a fascinating point in the course of your discussion of the interaction between Romney and Chris Christie, where you point, you have Christie getting off the phone and saying to someone, "You won't believe the conversation that I just had with Governor Romney," and it turned out the issue was SEC's pay-to-play regulation, and you argue that this, very quietly, that this is sort of the ticking time bomb, in the heart of campaigns that future governors might want to wage. Could you say a little bit more about that? I mean, that's just an extraordinary observation, and nobody else has made it. So, finally, this is the first and probably the last time I'll be able to say this to the best political reporter I know, and that is, I think you buried the lead. And here's what I mean.
That is over the line.
I know that, Well, we live in polarized times. I'm permitted to go with the stylistic flow. In the middle of the book, you report on Peter Hart's focus groups with the middle class, and they weren't just talking about unemployment. They were talking about fear of the future, the sense that the old rules have broken down with nothing to replace them, their belief that their children wouldn't do as well as they did. And then in a paragraph on the very final page, you point out that nothing in the campaign said by either candidate focused in a productive and forward-looking way on this fear. Mm-hmm. If people are interested, I'll read out loud that paragraph, but it's a wonderful paragraph from which I would reach the following conclusion. If campaigns are supposed to lay the foundation for successful governance, that is to say, a successful effort to grapple with the most important problems facing the country, then the 2012 election was a complete failure, and we're paying the price. As college professors would say, discuss.
And I have a question too, but I'm going to let Dan respond to these.
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to make a comment, and we're going to open it up. Okay.
All right. Well, as always, Bill has given me a smorgasbord of things to talk about, and provocatively so. Let me just tick down through them. The first one, the referendum on the president and the incumbent owning the economy. I can't fully explain why in the exit polls in 2012, George Bush is still tagged at that level, other than that there was still antipathy towards George Bush, still a recognition that the seeds of all of that happened on his watch, mm-hmm. That it was historically difficult for Obama to have to take on. And because, in a sense, throughout all of this, Obama was a more likable, was still a rather likable president to people, even those who were disappointed in him. And so I think people tended to cut him a little slack on that.
Just one interjection. I think it's also possible that the response to that question, even though the question was about the economy, the response wasn't about the economy. That is to say, it was a response of identity, like which side you're on. And if you're on, if politics is about sort of cultural identification with one side or the other, you're going to say Bush, whether or not that's real, the economy is the underlying
subject. But it's even beyond, I mean, I agree with that completely. I mean, I think so much is shaped by whether people say I'm a Republican or a Democrat. But I think on that particular issue, it went beyond that division. I mean, there was something in addition to that. And I think it was to some extent the slack that people still cut for Obama on that. the degree to which they avoided it being a referendum goes back to this point I made in my comments, which is they recognized that if it were a referendum, they were in big trouble. And so they created a message that completely ignored that. I mean, they did not want to ask people, how do you feel about things today? Or how do you feel about how the president did? They wanted this to be a discussion about which of these two candidates do you, as a middle-class voter, have more confidence in to take care of you? Who understands you better? And the second thing that they wanted to do was to disqualify Romney as a potentially good steward of the economy, which was, of course, his biggest calling card going in. I think the mystery is, and it's still not fully answered in the book, is why the Romney campaign was not more effective at rebutting that, why they were not more effective at filling in some biographical portrait of Mitt Romney that made him a more, a warmer, a more empathetic, or a more capable person to deal with the economy. So I think that in part, this was a situation, in, if you could say so, in contrast to what some political scientists might argue, campaigns really do matter. I mean, in framing that message and in the absence of a response, an effective response from the Romney campaign, they were able to make this less a referendum, a pure referendum on the president. The auto bailout, I think your point is absolutely right. I mean, it is hard to believe that he would have done as well in Ohio as he did in the absence of the auto bailout. I mean, I remember taking a trip with the president across northern Ohio. This was around the 4th of July in 2012. And I was sharing a car with John Dickerson and his producer, Sarah Boxer. And as we went across that, we were talking about this and said, you know, this is the election. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the entire election. Mm-hmm. It is the northern tier of Ohio, absolutely, and it is the auto bailout. And if you reduce the whole election to one thing, this is it. And this is Obama's route in. And if you look at the exit polling, Obama did demonstrably better with white non-college voters in Ohio than he did nationally by about 6 points.
6 points.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I have to believe that a lot of that was a share of that was the auto bailout. And a share of that was the disqualification or the portraiture of Romney as the guy who closed factories, not as a guy who would create jobs.
The Thurston Howell factor.
Yes, the Thurston Howell factor.
And just one interjection on that is Beth Myers came to talk to one of my classes right after the election, and the failure to more accurately rebut the Obama argument here, they blame on having no money between May and their convention. They actually blame this on, they said, we knew what was happening. We saw what Obama was doing to us in his ads in the swing states, and we had no money. We only could raise general election money. And so they have a response to it.
Yeah, well, I have a response to that response, namely, why didn't they have their convention in July?
Well, that I think was a decision that they was too, you know, by that time was done.
Everybody's playing the last war. I mean, I think there's Beth's absolutely right on the money piece of it, but I think that begs the question of, you know, all of the time period up until that point.
Until
they started an operation at the Romney headquarters, you know, in 2011, literally setting up the equivalent of a war room to deal with Bain. Bob White, who was Romney's business partner at Bain, and closest confidant in the campaign operation, knew every charge about Bain that was going to come at them. And they prepared all of the information. Of all of the things that had happened at Bain, there were only a handful of things that the Obama campaign went after. I mean, maybe three or four. They knew they were going to get hit on these. They had gotten responses. They had done everything. And yet they never effectively, engaged on that topic until they didn't have money to do it.
I want to go to two things related to the, you're talking about the auto bailout and the white working class thing. This gets back to the authenticity point that I was making, and I want to link it to a separate issue. Mitt Romney tried to make the argument in the campaign that Obama implemented his plan for saving the auto industry, because ultimately they got to a manage bankruptcy for the auto companies. That was fake, not true. Okay, so he was making an argument that was fundamentally not true. He, in the fall of 2008, wrote this article, which with the headline slapped on by my colleagues at the New York Times that said, "Let Detroit go bankrupt," but fundamentally said, "Don't put a dime in these companies." That was, in fact, his message. And he was doing that at a time when he was trying to gear up to appeal to surf the opinion in the base of the Republican Party against the bailouts that were going on in Washington. Well, that didn't look so good when he got to the general election and the economy in those states had recovered. So inauthentic, fake, that made it very difficult for him. Secondly, we haven't talked about health care yet. That is the fundamental fake sort of substantive fakery in his campaign. He enacted a health care plan before he recognized how unpopular it was in Massachusetts that essentially is identical to Obama's health care plan. Then when he's running for president, he's running around the country pretending that Obama's health care plan is the worst thing ever, and the first day in office, he's going to get rid of it. And I remember being in an off-the-record session with Romney early in the campaign and said, how are you going to deal with this fundamental issue of having implemented Obama's health care plan, which your party base hates? And he said, my health care plan wasn't like Obama's health care plan. I didn't cut Medicare. Well, of course he didn't cut Medicare because governors don't control Medicare. But in the core of what the plan is, it's the same plan. Now, yes, there is a difference between a state-level plan and a federal plan. And you can make a federalism argument, and Republicans tend to make those arguments when the thing is popular nationally, but they're trying to square the circle. I remember Lamar Alexander doing that on abortion in 1996. It was like, well, I'm completely pro-life and anti-abortion, but it's not a federal issue, and so he was going to try to sort of elide the issue that way. Romney tried to do that the whole year, and it was not, nobody believed it. It's kind of preposterous when you think about it. So,
good. Picking up, and then we'll get to you in a minute. So get your questions ready.
Let me quickly address the Christie pay-to-play issue. This is a totally, I mean, I had no idea this provision existed. It in essence says that if you are an employee in a financial institution that does bond work in a state or with a city, you can't contribute to the campaign of somebody who has some control over who gets awarded bond underwriting. This affects sitting governors who are running for president. This had existed before, but between 2008 and 2012, the SEC stepped in and broadened it. And it became an issue about whether Christie could be on the ticket with Romney. Romney was fine because he was an ex-governor. Christie was a sitting governor, and there was a question about if they put him on the ticket, could they raise money on Wall Street if he were part of it? And would they have to give money back that they had already raised? They decided that wasn't a problem. But so Romney called Christie at one point to talk about this. In the end, he picked Paul Ryan, I think, not because of pay-to-play but for other issues. But nonetheless, it is, as Bill says, a potential issue for any governor who decides to run in 2016, including Chris Christie.
And there are a lot of Republican governors.
And there are a lot of Republican governors. I mean, when I talked to Rick Perry's campaign about this, they said they ran into that problem when he was starting out his candidacy and looked for ways around it and concluded there was no way around it and basically said we had to shut down fundraising in New York.
We just,
you know, and that's $4 or $5 million. Now Perry could raise a lot of money elsewhere because of his Texas roots, and as it turned out, he didn't need much money. or put another way, all the money in the world might not have done anything better for him.
For those of you who haven't read the book, Dan's titled the chapter on Rick Perry, Oops.
Thank you for doing that.
John's key moment in the campaign.
Yes.
He blames you, John, for his demise. So.
He's very good-natured about it.
Actually, just a footnote on that. He thinks that that was not where his campaign fell apart. He believes his campaign was basically already in a downward spiral before that oops moment, and I think he's absolutely
he's
right
great.
On that. Bill, let me embrace or try to talk about two other things Bill raised. One is the question of the president and in a sense his leadership style. There's a quote in this. There are two things in this book that I wanted to highlight. One is a conversation I had with the president some years ago, asking him, I said, who gave you the best, as you were making that final decision to run in the 2008 campaign, which would have been in the fall, late fall of 2006, I said, who gave you the best advice? And he paused for a moment and he said, well, I think it would have to be the advice I gave myself. Now, that quotation was in
nice.
The 2008 book that Haynes and I did. It attracted absolutely no comment. People have seen it in this book, and it's like a light bulb went on. Because people obviously see the president differently today than they did immediately after the 2008 election. They've watched him govern, and so they recognize the degree to which he really is a singular kind of figure and relies so much on himself. And this notion of him saying again back in late 2008, it's not an issue of big government or small government, it's an issue of smart government. A, you can make the argument he has not successfully made the argument for smart government or even some version of bigger government. But B, I think, the president obviously went through an evolution in the first 4 years of his presidency. And, there was one period that goes through August of 2011, which is when the debt ceiling negotiations collapsed, in which I think he still held out hope that there was an opportunity to work with the Republicans. And at the moment that happened, he made the pivot. Now, he made the pivot for campaign political reasons at that point, which was, all right, we have to take this argument to the country. I can't sit in a room with John Boehner or anybody else and work this out. The Republicans, Boehner can't get his people to come along. So I've got to take this fight to the country. And that's when they made the pivot and did the middle class message. I think once he got reelected, he thought, as all presidents do, that he had an even greater mandate than he actually had coming out of 2012. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, he's operated since the second inaugural more like that person who made the pivot than a person who wanted to go back and negotiate. On the one hand, he's tried to negotiate with the Republicans. More recently, he has tried to, in a sense, argue, I won this election, this is where the country is, you all will pay a price. Neither has worked very successfully. And so now we're in a period where there's once again a reevaluation of the president's leadership style. I think this is going to be an enduring discussion and debate all the way through his presidency. Finally, the last point you make about me burying the lead. The point is right, and I wrote that paragraph at the end as a way to kind of highlight it. This ultimately was, this book is a narrative history. It's not an argument about some aspect of policy, but I think that's right. I mean, I think that for all the focus that the Obama campaign put on the middle class, neither he nor Romney came up with policies that were particularly fresh, innovative, or that they sold to the country. What we've seen...
Did he just confess to burying the lead?
I think he might have.
So what we've seen...
I think he said it was the lead in a different book.
In a narrative history, you put the lead toward the end, Bill. It's a construct that we journalists are familiar with. You have to leave people with a sense of where you want them to think it came out. The president episodically will... Or his people will say, well, he's now going to get back to the middle class issue. And he does this with events.
Does this with,
And he'll go out to the country and have an event to try to highlight that focus. But I mean, I think it's a measure of, in a sense, the kind of the stagnation of the policy debate that has existed. And it's a complicated question of how you deal not simply with, stimulating the economy more rapidly than it has shown over the last several years, but the even bigger problem of income stagnation or regression, income inequality. I mean, these are huge issues, and the question is, which party, as you go to 2016, may try to push the envelope in a fresh and new way. So,
absolutely.
So I'm going to have one quick comment on this, and I'll go to you, which is that the subtitle of this book kind of gets to this last point. It's the future of elections in America, not the future of America, right? It's the future of elections in America. And you set up a kind of interesting contrast between all the new technology, all the new things, first election under Citizens United, first election under the end of the collapse of the public finance system, first election where debates turn into, and I'm quoting Dan here, reality TV and get, enormous amount of attention. First election where there's this extraordinary emphasis on not just the new technologies but the analytics, which you described beautifully. So there's almost a turning point in elections, and there's such a contrast between the turning point in elections and the absence of a turning point in any policy ideas or anything like that. And I'm wondering, having established this new technology, and I'll say that broadly, okay, to include the new mode of elections, will everyone now do that? Does that then, is there now going to be a level playing field on that? Did Obama in 2012 have the first mover advantage technologically, and from now on that won't matter because everybody else is going to catch up?
Well, short answer is probably, but with a couple of caveats. What the Obama campaign was able to do in building this machine was as a result of the benefit of literally 5 years of working, or 5.5 years of working. I mean, it started in 2007. They broke some ground in 2008 with what they did, and then they never stopped. Mm-hmm. I mean, they moved over to the DNC and began experimenting with analytics, and they did after action report on what had worked and what had not worked in 2008. All of this was moving, and so they had, when they went out to Chicago in the spring of 2011, they had an idea of what they needed to do and the time and money to do it. Romney's operation, there was no way Romney's operation could catch up with that unless the RNC already had off-the-shelf stuff, and as we know, that's never sufficient.
But for the same reason, didn't Ken Mellman and Karl Rove do precisely the same thing so that in the 2004 campaign we got to the end and people said, wow, there's so much better
technology. That's my point. I mean, this ebbs and flows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, somebody gets an advantage and the other side goes to school on it, and a smart candidate overtakes, the other side. But I think that the techniques that we saw will become standard practice in 2016.
Okay, let's take a couple questions. So right here, the young lady.
Yeah. Hi, good morning. My name is Kristen Cabral, and I was wondering why there was no reporting of the down-ticket races, not only the U.S. Senate, but the U.S. House. And I asked because I was the Democrat running for the U.S. House in the swing district in Battleground, Virginia, just about 10 miles away. I was the only congressional candidate in Virginia for the Democrats running in the bellwether Loudoun County, as well as Fairfax and Prince William counties. And let me tell you that those matrixes out of Chicago brought my old law school classmate Barack Obama to my district quite a few times. I think focusing on these top marquee races tells less than half the story. I also disagree with you that the ground game was just important because it was decisive, as was the demographics in a battleground state like Virginia. And then finally, when it came to the lead, that was my campaign. I would say in speeches that if your government is not creating conditions to make it easier to put a roof over your head, food in the kid's mouth and on the table, and clothes on your back, then your government is broken, needs fixing, and put me in there. And on No Time and No Money as the accidental candidate, I had the second best performance in 25 years. There you go.
There you go. Let's take a, we'll take a couple questions and then let Dan respond to everyone. Yeah, right there.
How do you account for Romney? If you heard Romney up until Election Day, he was absolutely confident that he was going to be elected. What was the source of this confidence and whatever it became of the binders filled with women?
And let's have this question right here, and then you can remember three at once, right?
I think so.
Okay.
My name is Anthony Odie. I'm a consultant. Question about electability. Is it the case that in spite of all the flaws you've all discussed, Governor Romney was nonetheless the most electable, or at least the least unelectable of the candidates that presented themselves to the Republicans? And as just a supplement, when you spoke to him in January, did you get the sense Governor Romney felt that his running mate had added to the electability of the platform or otherwise?
Okay, Dan respond, and then I'll take a couple more.
First question is a fair question. For me, to tell the presidential story and then try to tell the down ballot is impossible, frankly.
Then the book would be this big.
Or it would be so superficial. Mm-hmm. Ron Brownstein and I did a book after the '94 election that looked at the consequence of a midterm election. But this is a story of a presidential election. So I can understand your frustration, but there are human limits for an author doing this. Romney's confidence was misplaced. In a sense, not necessarily misplaced at the beginning. I mean, Stuart Stevens was the sort of the conceptual person for the thinking about what this election, how this election would unfold, and the view was fairly straightforward. Bad economy, high unemployment, presidential approval below 50%, all those ingredients add up to a situation in which people are ready to vote out the incumbent. Mm-hmm. What Romney had to do was to demonstrate or gain people's confidence that he could do a better job on the economy, and that in the end, people would turn to him. That was plausible at the beginning, but as the election moved along and as we saw things happen, it became more challenging for them to do that. But that's when I say that their confidence was misplaced. It was willful misunderstanding or a blind view of the electorate that they were actually going to be dealing with. I think the Romney campaign made two fatal assumptions. One was that the electorate, as we've said, with each presidential election, the share of the electorate of white voters has ticked down. Still by far the dominant share, but it has ticked down election by election. The Romney campaign convinced themselves that that would not be the case this time, that it would probably stay where it had been in 2008 at 74%.
74%,
right?
Yeah.
As opposed to 72%, which was what the, when I talked to Jim Messina about this in the spring of 2012 and said, tell me what the electorate's going to be. He said it'll be 72% white, 28% non-white. So the Romney campaign made that misassumption. The second misassumption that they made was that the percentage of Republicans versus Democrats would be closer to 2010 than to 2008.
Yeah.
They were of the belief that the 2010 election signaled that there was a change in the composition in 2012 that was brewing. And this was driven home to them in the final weeks of the campaign when, after the Denver debate, he began to get not just big crowds, but extraordinarily enthusiastic crowds of a type that he had not seen earlier in the campaign. I mean, we know that most of the energy in the Republican base was aimed at getting rid of Obama, not because they love Mitt Romney. And in the final weeks, as he said to me, it went from being clinical to emotional, which is his way of saying they didn't just want to get rid of Barack Obama. They wanted to elect me. And so, you know, we've all seen losing campaigns at the end that have big crowds and enthusiastic crowds.
Dukakis had excellent crowds at the
end. And it is easy for a candidate to kind of lose focus. But the whole campaign got swept up in that, and so that was why.
And just one quick interjection. There's a direct connection between 74% versus 72% what the partisan balance is, given the nature of who's a Democrat and who's a Republican.
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly right.
As to the question of was Romney the most electable of the Republican candidates, I mean, if you look at that field, ultimately, yes. Now, one of the things I did is I ended up doing two chapters on the people who didn't run.
Yeah.
And with the idea of if certain other people had run, would Mitt Romney have been the nominee? You know, people like Haley Barbour or, you know, Mitch Daniels, Mike Huckabee.
Tim Pawlenty,
and Chris Christie. Romney said to me one of his early doubts about whether he should even run was the question of, am I the strongest Republican to go against President Obama? And this was a question he had in 2010 as he was looking at this race. And he said, if somebody like Jeb Bush had run, I might not have run, because he thought Bush might be a more effective candidate to go against the president. Once he saw the field as it shaped up, he decided he was clearly the class of the field and would be the strongest. So did they put up their best candidate? No. I mean, Rick Perry had the best line of all when he came to the Gridiron Dinner in the spring of 2012. And he said, I ran against the weakest Republican field ever, and they kicked my butt. it was not a strong Republican field, and in that sense, you could say that that Romney was the most presentable of that group.
Yeah. Great. Okay, let's go here and here and here.
Oh, we'll I'm sorry. The Ryan question.
Ryan, yeah.
I think he thinks he made the right decision with Ryan. He liked Ryan. He admired Ryan. He liked the idea that they could try to make the election about the debt and the deficit. I don't think they effectively were able to do that. I don't think he had any second thoughts about Ryan.
Okay. Let's see. One, two, and three. Yes. You can do three again, huh?
Sure.
I'm Gary Tyron with Community Action Partnership. Dan, per Romney's 47% comment, what is your assessment about the subsequent response from that in influencing the president's policies?
Great. Mitch?
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I'm also the only person, apparently, who got Elaine's memo today about green slacks and orange on the feet. It's fascinating to me. We're in the closing moments of a discussion about Mitt Romney, and the word Mormon has not surfaced. And so I thought I'd do that, and I want to do it in this way. One of the most remarkable features, I believe, and I gather you frame that in your book, is about the inauthenticity of this man. And so one wonders what the basis for that might be and where that might come from. In August of 2012, The New Yorker did a book review, four books on Mormonism that was quite fascinating. One of which, and two of these books are written by Mormons, or three, reports on the day when, and I'm not sure what the title is, but the highest official in the Mormon Church declared that African Americans were now admitted, allowed to become part of the church. And he was asked at that conference by a reporter who had attended a session 3 months earlier where that same grand official said, in regard to the question, over my dead body. And the reporter asked the grand official of the Mormon, how do you explain that 3 months ago it was over his dead body and today it is with conviction that he endorses the notion that African Americans are now part of the church? And he explains that a basic principle of Mormonism is the belief that in Revelation, that when a revelation comes along, that it erases, it's like Etch-a-Sketch. It erases everything else that's come before. And I wondered two questions about Mormonism. One is, was it such a third rail issue that really nobody in the media explored that much, wrote about that much, which probably would not have been the case if he'd been a Scientologist, for example. And second, to any extent, do you think that something like the strictures of his Mormon faith often made it difficult for him to speak with a not forked tongue about the issues of Medicare and others, the health care plan and others? So I'm really looking for whether you saw in any way that issue of his faith imposing on his ability to speak plainly. And second, I'm also interested in why that the subject of Mormonism simply was verboten by in the press.
Over here.
Thank you. My name is Sebastian. I'm with the Danish Embassy here in D.C. Thank you, first of all. My question goes to the future of elections in America and specifically 2016. And I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on the likability of a candidate versus the demographic sort of changes that we're seeing. You say that the demographics are trending Democratic and maybe even more so than we thought in 2010. So let's assume that the GOP nominates a generally electable candidate. I know that's a big assumption, but let's do that. And how much would it take for, let's again assume, a Hillary Clinton to recreate the connection with voters? Like, I'm asking, how much work would she do in order to be likable versus how much would she get for free from demographic changes trending the way of her policy positions?
Great.
Okay. 47% and how it may have affected the president's policies. The 47%, I mean, you could argue that that was the crystallizing moment and therefore sunk Mitt Romney. I think there are lots of other things that ultimately contributed to his defeat, but there was no single moment that sort of summed up the case against Mitt Romney that the Obama campaign had been trying to make. That this is somebody who was out of touch with, the average person, insensitive to them. I can't see that it had much effect in terms of policy that the administration has done. They seized on it politically, but I don't think it has carried beyond that, other than continuing to frame some of the Democratic arguments about Republican economics. So I would leave that at that. The question of Mormonism is a great question. I did not deal with it in any significant way in the book, in part because I did not think that in the end it was decisive in any way. But I'll say a couple of things about it. One is Romney was certainly aware of that being a potential obstacle to him, particularly in winning the nomination. He said to me that, and Stuart Stevens said it to people all the way through the campaign, he said, Stuart always said to me, this is not going to be an easy nomination to win for these reasons. This is a southern-based party. You're a northerner. This is an evangelical-based party. You're a Mormon. This is a very conservative party. You're, in Stuart's words, you're you're conservative, but you're a conservative from Massachusetts. I think that they were unwilling to talk about religion in any way. And I think that became a problem in this regard. If you watched the Republican convention on the last night, if you were watching not in prime time, you saw an elderly couple come out and talk about how Mitt Romney had taken their son under his wing when their son was dying of cancer at age 14, as I recall. And it was a poignant story that said a lot about Mitt Romney that the campaign had never been able to say or never chosen to say about him. You never saw those people in an advertisement. The only time you did was something that American Crossroads, Karl Rove's group, put up toward the end of the campaign. These were people from his church. He knew this young man and this couple from his church. It tells you so much that they, for whatever reason, decided they couldn't go near that or wouldn't go near that. And the question is it simply because it would have drawn attention to the fact that he was Mormon? I don't know the answer to that. They give more complicated reasons for why they didn't do it. But at any rate, I think
it's a big mistake.
And I was going to ask, you seem to be raising on the Mormon question authenticity issue, and I wanted to hear John's reaction.
Well, I just
to that,
wanted to. The reason I think it's a big mistake was that was an authentic part of his character that was buried.
Right.
And there's a gamble, right? It's an evangelical party, it's a Southern party, and Mormonism is not popular among Southern evangelicals. Fair enough. But especially running against a weak field, you've got to make some gambles and take some calculated risk, or even if you did it after the primary. My point is the more ways in which Americans like people of faith, period.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the faith part trumps the whatever negatives exist with the Mormon part, and the authenticity, like this is who Mitt Romney is deep down, I think that would have benefited him more than they recognized.
Okay, and you're...
And 2016, and Hillary Clinton. Obviously, demographics are powerful, but a candidate has to present him or herself in an attractive and appealing way, the idea that any Democrat can simply ride the waves of demographic change or whatever in 2016, I think is folly. It's not easy for a political party to win three consecutive elections.
Right.
There may be Obama fatigue by the time we get to 2016. We don't know what the country's judgment will be about. We really need a big change. And so I think any Democrat, whether it's, whether it's Secretary Clinton or anybody else who may run, has got to come up with a way to make a presentable argument about the future and to make themselves as appealing and likable as they can.
Ask yourself as a matter of identity, African Americans turned out actually at higher rates than whites did in the 2012 election. Is Martin O'Malley, if he's the Democratic nominee, is that electricity going to exist that fuels turnout like that? No. Hillary Clinton might, but it's not automatic.
Okay, let's see. We have room for one more last question, and I neglected the back, but they're done. Ah, yes, all the way back there. Yes.
Obviously, the Republicans paid a lot of attention to the turnout issue, and so they've been busy wrenching down on days of voting, voter ID, that kind of thing. Looking forward, do you think that the Republican squeeze on election day voting and other things, do you think that will clearly they're trying to offset the demographic changes. Do you think, given the widespread tactics they're engaged in, do you think that will have an effect in 2016?
Well, I think that there's certainly a potential for a backlash against that. a smart campaign and a good campaign will figure out how to maximize the number of days available to get people to the polls. I mean, if it's fewer than it was, you know, a good campaign will figure out how to deal with that as best they can. But having said that, I mean, I think that efforts to restrict or cut back or in any way make it look like you're making it more difficult for people to vote comes with a political consequence on the other side. And I think we saw some of that in 2012. I mean, I think that, John's right, the enthusiasm for Obama in the African-American community was in part because of you know, racial identity. But I also think it was in part because this sense of we're not going to let the other side make it more difficult. I mean, we saw these huge lines down in Florida for the early vote. And I think that was a recognition. I mean, when you talk to the Obama team about the African-American vote in particular, they said there was an almost a palpable sense of we've got his back, and we'll do that. Now, you know, is that transferable to any other candidate? Not necessarily. But nonetheless, you know, this is a politically charged debate that's going on about, you know, about the terms under which states hold elections. And so it's, you know, for every push in one direction, there can be a push in the other.
It's a dead-end strategy.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I want to thank so much John Harwood from CNBC and the New York Times, Bill Galston from Brookings, for coming to help us discuss and celebrate Collision 2012. And I want to remind everyone that there are books for sale out there, and Dan is going to stick around and sign books. So please get one. You're going to have a lot of fun with it. Thank you very much.